Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based gardening expert, author of more than 20 books. She is the host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and it's always a real treat when she stops by to visit with us about what's going on in her garden and to answer questions about what's going on in your garden. And I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show, and we'll get you right in with your question. And Melinda, hi.
Good morning, Larry. It's great to chat with you, and good to talk gardening with all your listeners.
Yeah, I tell you, it's great to have you with us. When the weather changes like it did all over the state in the last couple of weeks, it sort of feels like the gardening season's getting over, but that's a long way from the truth. Let's start with the vegetables that are still growing right now.
You know, I think we've all been waiting for tomatoes. What I'm hearing from gardeners all over, it's either been a banner year or a bad year. Seems to be nothing
right.
In between. I had one woman tell me she harvested 300 tomatoes off of one Roma tomato. I know. That wasn't my backyard, I have to admit. And I think some of us, I got a late start because of the cool, wet weather, like so many people, and a busy schedule. And so my tomatoes are just starting to come in. So I think I'm going to be cheating this season a little for my peppers, tomatoes, and eggplants, and probably break out the floating row covers just for a little added heat to kind of speed up the ripening, protect them from these cool nights, and keep things going. But the greens are doing great. If you've got broccoli, cabbage, and Brussels sprouts, cool temperatures are the best thing for them. The flavor's better. They'll even take a light frost. So that's really good. And keep harvesting because, you know, it's Wisconsin, and we could have 2 days left of the growing season or 2 months.
You never know, do you?
Exactly.
Oh, my tomatoes and some of my plants, Mr. Stripey's.
Oh, okay. Those are just the most interesting looking tomatoes.
Yeah, well, they sat there, and they were kind of like full grown and green, and they wouldn't turn. And they finally have turned. So Mr. Stripey tastes pretty good.
I know. And, you know, it is. I was talking to somebody, and I said, you know, this is the time of year that's so easy to eat healthy. You know, you go in your backyard, pluck from the containers, visit the farmer's market, your neighbors share their extra zucchini, squash, whatever. It's so easy to eat healthy. The flavor is great. And, you know, I think we all need to just take advantage of this time of year. And, you know, you could even get a few plantings of greens in. Think about popping in a few herbs maybe that you're either going to grow indoors. So if you can't have fresh from your garden vegetables, at least fresh from the windowsill herbs to season up your canned frozen veggies or what you need to purchase when the weather cools down. So still a lot going on, you know, still, and then planting. You know, this is a great time to get trees, shrubs, perennials in the ground. Soil's warm, the air's cool. It's easier for us to plant and maintain, and easier for the plants to get established, too.
We had a Facebook question from Wendy, who, and this goes back to the tomatoes. Hers never ripened. She planted the Romas and 55s, and they started producing fruit in late July, but just sat there and never ripened. But hang on, wait some more.
The voice of experience, right, Larry?
Yeah.
You had the same thing. And the good thing is you can ripen tomatoes inside. Let's hope we're not there yet. But, you know, green tomatoes are great fried to make a cha-cha, which is kind of like a salsa sauce that you can put on burgers and sandwiches. And also you can ripen them inside, too, preferably if they're showing a little bit of color. You know, keep them in a cool place, cool, dark place, and then bring them up to a warm location, you know, a couple days before you want to eat them. And I grew up with a dad that grew the best tomatoes in our neighborhood, and we always had a ping pong table full of tomatoes way past Thanksgiving. So, you know, I didn't play ping pong in the fall in the basement, but we had the best tomatoes at Thanksgiving.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Well, Kathleen in Milwaukee has a question for you or a follow-up. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi. How can I help?
My question is, in early spring I have tulips all along the front of my house, which is beautiful. Then I have some perennial flowers that come up and are beautiful for about 3 weeks. They die, but they crowd out everything else. So this year I pulled them all out. I think that I spent probably 8 hours doing it, and planted some iris. Will you believe they have all come back and they're practically crowding out my iris? Now, I want to not kill my tulip bulbs by killing them with a spray because pulling them didn't work. What should I do?
Good question. There are some aggressive plants, and it depends on how you feel about chemicals. If you don't mind using a total vegetation killer like Roundup or another glyphosate-containing product, you know, if the plants are dormant, there shouldn't be a problem. But what I like to do in those kind of cases is wipe it on. A gardener gave me this great idea. I'd met his neighbor, and they called it the tongs of death, and they put sponges on the ends of tongs, and then they could wipe the plants, and it minimizes the impact of the product in the soil. Glyphosate's absorbed by the leaves, kills the top and the root system, so you minimize the impact or the risk to your surrounding plants. Once it hits the soil, it basically breaks down. You obviously don't want it pooling or touching the leaves of other plants and stems, especially young trees or tender perennials. So by wiping it on, you can really locate it. If it's of that aggressive of a plant, you're probably going to need several applications. There is a new broadleaf weed killer, but I wouldn't use it in your garden, even though you're growing mostly bulbs, because you may impact some of your other perennials. So spot treating, give it time, go according to the recommended rate. If you do it too strong, you burn out the top, it's not moved to the roots, and then you're probably going to have to do it. Anything that you dig, it sounds like it's rhizomaceous, meaning it has those underground stems that every little piece starts a new plant. So it's one you're probably going to do battle with for a few years just to get it under control, mulching, continually pulling as you find it, and then treating. Probably your best a combination of those things will probably, and persistence, you'll probably beat it.
Good luck. Thank you, Kathleen, for calling. Appreciate it. And Walter in Park Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Walter.
Good morning, Larry. Sometime back you had, I believe, the fellow from Prairie Nurseries on, and this gal called in about a shrub for hummingbirds. And the shrub had miniature or microscopic insects on it that the hummingbirds ate. And I couldn't remember the name of the shrub.
That question's for you, Larry. I listened to Neil's show, part of it. I didn't get to hear all of it. And it wasn't buttonbush. I'm guessing just some prairie-type plants. Was there anything more that you could tell us about
the it was only like 3 to 4 feet tall.
Okay.
And it had like these microscopic insects on it.
He didn't say anything about the blooms?
No, he didn't. He just said you'd have so many hummingbirds, you wouldn't know what to do.
I wish I could remember, but I can't. We might be able to. We might be able to ask Neil that. We can shoot him an email and see if he can come up with an answer for us. So stay listening.
That would be great.
Yeah, sorry, and I missed that part of the show, so I'm going to have to ask to copy on that answer too. So.
We'll see what we can do, and we'll post it on our Facebook page
That would be great.
Jill in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks for calling.
Good. Yes, my question is about a lilac bush. I've had it for 12 to 14 years, and it took like 7 years for it to bloom. And when it finally did, I never wanted to trim it because I was afraid if I cut anything off, it would... wouldn't bloom again.
Yeah.
But now it's getting to be such a monster, and I was just wondering, is now a bad time to trim it, you know, to cut the 2-inch stalk off of it, or should I wait till spring?
Great question. Things that bloom in the spring, lilacs, forsythia, bridal wreath spirea, have already set their flower buds for next year. Now, if you're talking about just removing the seed head, it's right above the flower buds, you're okay, but you don't want to prune into the stem, okay? Those flower buds have already formed. For overgrown lilacs, here's what I would suggest. You can prune them in late winter, but you'll be eliminating the bloom, okay? But if you're doing a couple of major stems right to ground level, that's a great way to rejuvenate, to get growth at the base, and then do your trimming from the top down after they bloom. Now, what you prune out in late winter, you could bring inside and try to force it into bloom. If you don't want to sacrifice flower, do not want to sacrifice flower, do all your pruning right after flowering, you know, by June 1st if possible. You know, if it's usually lilacs or mid to late May bloomers, so soon after they finish flowering, that's when you do your flowering to prevent elimination of any bloom. So they've already set their flower bud. So
isn't that about
I shouldn't do anything to it now. I should wait until spring.
If you want flowers.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If for some reason I choose to do it now and I don't get flowers, will it flower the following year?
Yeah. And you know what? If I was going to prune, I would wait till late winter at this point. If you're not worried about flowers, because you'll eliminate them if you're pruning any time after they start setting. I think, were you going to chime in, Larry, that, you know, if you get it by July 1st, you're usually okay?
Yeah.
I just figure gardeners always cheat, so I give you a pretty early deadline. So, yeah, it's close enough.
That's close enough.
But, yeah, you'll eliminate blooms if you prune now. And I think, is it in your way, or what's making you feel like you need?
Well, it does kind of block the walkway out into my backyard and from our deck, and that's why I was going to trim it, because, you know, I in the wintertime it's not so bad, because then there's no leaves or anything.
Yeah.
But,
well, if you could stand it, then I would wait till after it blooms and then do your trimming, because that'll be early enough in the season that you should be able to enjoy it and then take care of it. With lilacs and just kind of in general, what I was mentioning is taking a couple of the old stems right back to the ground, and if you do that every year for a few years, and then occasionally throughout the lifespan of the plant, that's one great way to keep it short, and you'll have leaves from the ground up to the tip. And so it sounds like a lot of work, but really it's a lot less work when you get into the groove. Better for the plant. And
a lot better.
Yeah, exactly. And you can really control the size. So, you know, if you can wait, I'd wait till after it blooms, because that's the reason we have lilacs in our property. And, boy, they're beautiful and can't be.
Oh, I love them. I love them.
And the fragrance by your deck must be wonderful.
Mm. It is. It is.
Thanks,
and
Jill.
In fact, I go out there and I smell the lilac, and there's one particular, it's right at nose level, and I smell all the scent out of it.
Okay, that's a picture that's going to get me through the winter. Thank you.
Thanks, Jill. Thanks a lot for calling. Ah, that's a good comment. I like that. Cam in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Cam.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is regarding an azalea on the property. We moved into a place in Madison that had basically a 30-year garden, and we've maintained it. And 2 years ago, I saw webs forming on the branches, and some of the leaves turned black. It didn't bloom as fully. This year, I did not see web, but I did see leaves turning black, and the ends of the branches turned very brittle.
And I'm sorry, and what was the plant again? I'm sorry.
It's an azalea.
Oh, an azalea. And a couple things. You sometimes see webbing from garden spiders, but you can also see with high populations of spider mites some webbing at time. And they suck plant juices, secrete a clear sticky substance called honeydew, and then a sooty mold will form on that sticky substance. And their feeding can cause some drying and crispiness. That's a possibility. Did this blackening happen coming right out of winter, or was it more midsummer?
It was when it started to bloom in, late spring.
Okay. Then that probably isn't spider mites. Typically, we don't see them that early. They're more of a summer thing. Winter damage and winter desiccation can cause the damage that you described. Broadleaf evergreens and azaleas, which tend to drop their leaves, typically that group of rhododendrons, just really struggle sometimes through our winter. So keeping them in a somewhat protected spot, making sure they're well watered, really important for us this year with so many of us having dry summers, making sure things are well watered, mulching the soil, and coming out in spring, we've had two good wet years. You know, so moisture shouldn't have been a problem in spring.
you may want to, if this make sure it gets plenty of water this fall going in. If we have a cool, wet spring again and you're seeing the problem, it may, in fact, be an issue with a fungal disease. Pruning out and destroying that infected material might be one option. If it, third year, you may want to contact the plant disease diagnostic clinic, especially if you have several plants. If it seems to outgrow the problem, then it's probably more response to the environment. If it spreads and gets worse, sounds like you may have a disease issue, and it might be worth definitely clean up and sanitation, remove infected parts. But if you're seeing it again after that, you might want to contact Brian Huddleston and his team.
We actually saw that same kind of thing happen to two Nanking cherry trees.
Okay, and sometimes there's a disease that cherry trees will get. There are a couple of diseases, and insects, boring insects will cause that. You'll get some dying back. Fire blight can be a problem on all the Rosaceae family, which
right.
is different than the azaleas, which can cause that blackening and curling. So there might be two disease problems happening with very different disease problems happening with very
similar looking
systems. Right.
That happens a lot.
Yeah, because azaleas, one of the things when I used to teach, I'd always, tell my students is you need to know the plants and what families they're in, because a lot of insects and disease have preferences based on, all the members of the rose family, or a lot of them get certain things like scab and fire blight and certain insects like them, and certain members of the azalea and rhododendron family have certain issues. So way more information than you needed. Sorry.
Thanks.
But keep an eye on it. And then if it happens next spring, I would take a photo and send it over to the plant disease diagnostic clinic.
Sounds great. Thank you very much, Cam, for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest, Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books, and the host of Melinda's Garden Moments. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Melinda Myers on this edition of Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Questions, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And by the way, for the caller who called in about the shrub that the hummingbirds were really attracted to that Neil DeBole talked about, that we got a Facebook comment from Cindy, and she says the shrub is New Jersey tea.
Oh, great.
So it's New Jersey tea. And Cindy from Duluth, thank you so much. And we have a caller, Kathy, now from Wausau. Kathy, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Kathy. How can I help?
Yeah, I have a couple questions on butternut squash.
Okay.
A late friend told me that if you cut some of the runners while they're bearing, that the squash that's on further back will ripen faster.
What happened, it's very similar with tomatoes, too, and I'm glad you brought this up because I forgot to mention it. Pinching out the growing tip of vining plants like squash and cucumbers and tomatoes that are indeterminate that grow and keep flowering and fruiting until they die, by pinching out the growing tip, you stop that growth so you don't get more flowers, and so the energy can go into ripening the fruit that's already started to form. So that's one thing a lot of gardeners will do this time of year, is because it's like, okay, we have a month maybe left, depending on where you are in Wisconsin, and so we want to get things ripe, and if things aren't moving as quickly, by removing that growing tip, the plant puts the energy into the fruit. So it was good advice, and so I'm glad you brought that up, because there might be others going, oh, that's what I need to do.
Okay, and my other question is with butternut squash also. Once they're ripe, like we have squash, and mostly all of them ripen, but there's a few that didn't. Will they ripen once they're off the...
Off the vine?
Right. Usually not. Winter squash is, it's not like tomatoes that continue to ripen.
Mm-hmm.
You want to pick them as close to being ripe as possible. If they're just slightly shy, the flavor will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You get the best flavor if you harvest them when they're ripe, but they're not something that really continues to do the ripening process. So,
hey.
And I had to laugh. I had a bizarre squash. It just makes me think, So a lot of people throw those in their compost pile, and if the seeds are fully developed, you may get some surprises growing in your compost pile next year. So just keep that in mind. It's okay. It won't hurt anything, but and the fruit's edible. It just won't look the same as the parent plant. So
there you go.
A fun thing.
Thanks, Kathy. Thank you for calling. Gary in Franklin. Let's go to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning. Question is, I want to help my garden along, get ready for next spring. I know cleaning all the dead plant material and all the old plant material all very well. As naturally as possible, how can I amend the soil just to add more nutrients to it?
And this is a vegetable garden?
Vegetable garden.
Okay.
Vegetable garden.
I'm really big about using all the products that are in your yard. I love to take the leaves from, you know, I live on a small city lot, but I have a big street tree, and so I shred the leaves and leave them on my lawn, but I usually have extras, so I shred them and work them into my garden. Some people have adopted the lasagna garden method, which is really layering newspapers and leaves and compost and creating an added garden. Making or purchasing compost, a good quality product, is another good way to dig that in. You're right, any disease or insect-infested stuff off. There's some new look at not tilling the garden and just mulching it and doing no-till method. I kind of grew up with turning over the garden, you know, ripping out the bad stuff, turning over the good stuff into the garden. And then I also find that by when it's mulched over winter, it's slower to warm up. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a reality to deal with. So those are kind of the two ways, is to either layer it on top. I usually work my leaves into the garden. I make my own compost. I supplement it also with compost that if I don't have enough, any organic matter, you know.
How about mushroom compost? Have you used it much? Or
yeah, I have. I usually find for me it's an availability issue. I used to have a pretty good nearby source where I could buy it in bulk. And I know there's been some concern about salt buildup, but I have not personally had that problem with it. And I've used it in containers. I've used it in the garden as well. I think compost is a great way to recycle waste, whether it's from your yard or you know, a municipality, if you know it's good quality, or a process like mushroom farming.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had really good luck. And most of us have lousy soil. So anything we can do to improve it, fall's a great time to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Can I ask you real quick, if I wanted to add like a general fertilizer, like a 10-10-10, should I wait till spring to put that in just to help the soil along too?
Yeah, and one of the things you may want to consider is years of doing 10-10-10 fertilizer have resulted in high to excessive levels of phosphorus and potassium in our soil.
Okay.
So you may want to get a soil test because what we're finding is adding more, the plants don't use it at the same rate. They do nitrogen, and so we're ending up with more. I think a lot of you know I'm a huge fan of Milorganite, and one of the reasons is low in phosphorus, it's non-leaching, but when the microorganisms work on it, it releases phosphorus and potassium in the soil. But fall is a great time to do a soil test because most people aren't thinking about it. So once you're done with your garden, take a soil test, send it to the lab, and then you're ready to go for fertilizing in spring.
Yep.
Perfect.
Good idea.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Gary.
Thanks for calling. And Paul in Cascade, it's your turn. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
I want to maybe get a little technical, but I hope not too technical.
Okay. We'll try to keep up with you.
Calcium
mm-hmm.
and tomato blossom end rot.
Mm-hmm.
Is all forms of calcium the same?
Well, the first thing that I would encourage you to do before you add calcium is see if that's really the problem. In our state, typically we have enough calcium in our soil, and so it's a moisture imbalance. And so before you invest in calcium, I find that adjusting the watering is usually sufficient for most people, keeping the soil watering thoroughly to encourage deep roots, mulching to keep the soil consistently moist. I do a lot of containers, and I'm using a lot of potting mixes, and I typically don't have blossom end rot unless it's been an extremely hot year or I push something into a pot too small. There are some calciums that are more quickly released. I have to tell you honestly, I used to poo-poo the eggshell thing. And then Jeff Gilman, who's a professor out of the University of Minnesota, I heard him speak, excellent speaker, who did a book on garden remedies, the truth about garden remedies, and the truth about organic gardening, two different books,
did some research and found there was some calcium available there, too. Calcium, how it reacts to your soil with your pH is also important, and what other nutrients are in your soil.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I guess I'd like to see you do a soil test before you invested in calcium, because you may not even need it.
Yeah, and then the watch the watering.
Watch
next.
The watering, or just try watching the watering, see if that works for you.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for calling, Paul. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Deb in Chippewa Falls. My calla lily plant in a pot has berries on it, and I'd like to keep them for next spring to plant. What's the best way to store them, and which is better for the plant now, to take out of the pot and let it rest in a cool root cellar, or leave it in the pot and bring inside for the winter and care for it as a regular house plant?
You know, actually, the way it's easiest for you, you know, if you're really good about keeping your plants watered and doing a good job, then what you'll want to do is just keep it in, grow it in a bright location and grow it like a house plant. It may go through a dormant period, but then you can revive it. Or if you're a busy person or don't have a lot of window space, lift it up after a light frost and store it like you do your other non-hardy bulbs. Fairly easy to store them. A cool location, lift it, let it cure, which means any of the, you know, wounds or anything in the digging process close, remove the foliage, lightly brush off the soil, pack it in peat moss or sand, store it in a cool, dark spot. As for the seeds, you can collect them. You'll want to get them out of the fleshy berry. And one of the ways you can do that, and it's kind of a fun way you can also do with tomatoes, is you throw them in warm water, put them in a warm, dark place for 2 weeks. They kind of ferment. Good seeds drop to the bottom. The heavy ones drop to the bottom. The gunk floats to the top. Pour that off. And you can plant those. It takes a couple of months, though, for them to germinate. So it's one of those things you're going to plant, keep it in a place, keep the soil slightly moist, and just wait, and then
wait.
But, you know, I think part of the fun of gardening, and you know this too, Larry, from all the gardeners you get to chat with, is it's about experimenting. Oh, you know, yeah. I was telling somebody who was asking me this morning, so can I overwinter this plant indoors? And it took us a while to figure out what it was. She didn't know the name, and I said, well, I've never done it, but give it a try. I try something new every year just so I can say, I've done it, or it didn't work. I'm going to try a second time.
Okay. We have an email from Ruth. Do you know of a source for Chinese flat-leaf garlic chives? The garlics are planted in fall, correct?
Yeah. Yes. And I don't know if Marcia Carmichael, who's now at Old World Wisconsin, Sunshine Farm Flowers and Herbs, in I think East Troy, used to sell it. Farmers markets are a great source, I find. She used to be the herb lady in West Allis. I'm sure in Madison, we're lucky in Wisconsin, we have quite a few farmers markets.
Right.
That might be a good place to go check it out. And if you have an herb society in your area, those would be my first. And where was she from again, did she say?
She didn't say, I don't think. Oh, wait a second. No. She didn't say.
Okay, so check in your, you know, sometimes garden centers will carry, I haven't seen it readily available, so it might be an order it online at Renee's Gardens, Cook's Gardens, one of those kind of specialty.
Yep.
I'll tell you, the internet's wonderful. Do a Google search. And then check with your local farmer's market as well. They may have some.
Mm. Marcia's going to be on in a couple of weeks to talk about her book.
Oh, excellent. You know what, she is, you guys have to tune in. She is not only very knowledgeable, I've learned so much, but she's entertaining too, as you know. So, yeah, call back. She may tell you where you can find it.
There we go. Kevin in Oregon, we go to you now. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, hi. I have a fire bush, and I've had some problems maintaining adequate foliage on it. It's a new planting, about 2 to 3 years old. And I'm wondering, it started out well in the spring. I got a lot of new growth. The leaves look good. And then the edges started getting brown, and the leaves started getting a little not looking good. And then now it just sort of has a few leaves on it, but I have a lot of little green growth at the bottom of the bush. I did a feeding in the spring, and it is in a rock mulch area, and I'm just trying to figure out what I might be experiencing.
And I just want to make sure I'm thinking of the same plant, burning bush, the one that turns bright red in the fall?
Yes, correct.
Okay, good. I wanted to make sure I was not going to answer incorrectly for you.
firebush or burning bush likes well-drained soil, so that's not a bad thing. They have a hard time in a heavy clay where it's poorly drained. Now, is it rocky all the way down, or is it gravelly on the surface and heavy clay beneath?
No, it's in an area of landscaping where I have pavement on the left and pavement on the right, and we have probably about, oh, I don't know, maybe 40 square feet of soil, and then it has the felt and the rocks on top. So it is getting plenty of heat, and I thought I was getting some sort of heat stress.
Okay.
And when I actually rolled the mulch back and put a organic matter in a bag of mulch on top, and I'm just trying to figure out what to do if I have a disease, or it seemed out okay, and then it died back, and that's sort of where I'm at.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, so here's the deal. If your soil is poorly drained, so you have a rock mulch, I'm sorry, misunderstood, and this new plantings, especially this year in young plantings, it takes a couple years for trees and shrubs to get established, okay? So thorough and less frequent waterings. I run my landscape pretty light on water. I try to go with drought-tolerant plants, but boy, it's been dry for me that I've had to water, you know, once a week this last month just because stuff is so dry and showing signs of drought stress. So thorough and less frequent watering. You're right, rock mulch tends to warm up more in the summer, cool off in the winter, reflect heat, and it doesn't improve our soil, and most of us have lousy soil beneath. So the other thing you're going to want to do is kind of peel back and see what's happening in the soil beneath the mulch. Is it staying moist? Is it drying out fast? And then maybe even taking a pipe to get down a good 6 or 8 inches, pull a plug of soil up and find out what's happening deep. You know, it might feel moist the top inch, but you really need that moisture going down deep. So I think your first thought is watch the moisture. Organic mulch is going to keep things a little bit cooler right around the plant, so that's good. Fertilizing, we tend to always try to fix things with fertilizer, and we tend to have very rich soils here, so less is better. It's good to give it a good year before you fertilize new plantings, and then only if needed. And again, using a low nitrogen fertilizer, slow release, really eliminates the problem with damaging the roots. Sometimes if we try to push growth, we often get in the way of helping the plant recover. So I think you're on the right track. Watch your moisture. Plants, if you look around, have really taken a beating this year with not only the dry, but the heat. The heat was pretty brutal, and even if you were watering, some plants couldn't pull the moisture up fast enough to not avoid problems with scorch. So too much can be just as bad, but thorough, less frequent. Check the moisture. These cooler temperatures are good for our plants. Some of us are experiencing high winds. That's very drying, too. So I think you're on the right track. Just continue. And hold off on the fertilizer. You did it last spring. You don't need to do it for another year or so.
There you go, Kevin. Thank you very much for calling. And Rose in Menominee Falls, your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hello there. I have a beautiful Mandevilla plant that I actually had last summer, and I tried to bring it in over the winter because I just couldn't bear to let it go.
I have two that I'm going to do the same thing this year.
And, of course, it lost most of its leaves, and the problem was it got white fly. I'm pretty sure it was. And by the time I noticed it, it was pretty advanced, but I babied it all winter long. I swabbed the leaves with alcohol and put insecticidal soap on it, which I do with all my plants before I bring them in, and I did with this one. So I put it, but it survived, and I put it back out this summer. It took a long time, but it's gorgeous. It has glossy leaves and lots of beautiful flowers. If I bring it in again this winter, should I put something systemically in it before I bring it in? I always do the insecticidal soap, and then I'll watch it more closely so I could try and catch something earlier. But is there any advice for what to do to bring that in?
Yeah, there's so few systemic insecticides labeled for houseplants right now, so you're going to want to have to look hard on the pesticide shelf in your garden center. I have pets, so I don't choose not to use those because I worry about my cats eating the leaves because sometimes they're not that bright about what they choose to chew on.
Uh-huh.
And but one of the things, if you don't want to do that and want to go a little more eco-friendly, there are some good natural products besides neem oil. There's also some natural products that contain canola and other plant oils. And the benefit of those is they suffocate the eggs as well as killing the immature whitefly. Part of the problem with whitefly is their life cycle is so quick, and they go from egg to adult and laying eggs so fast that even using traditional pesticides, synthetic pesticides, or the soap, really making applications every 5 days and keeping up with it, it's important to get them under control. Yellow sticky traps won't control them all, but it might reduce the population enough that the plants can tolerate it. So if you can find an insecticide, and I was just looking on the shelf the other day, and I can't remember the active ingredient. I found a systemic at my local garden center, so you might want to check that. Read the directions. I haven't used it on Mandevilla. And then otherwise, use something maybe a little more eco-friendly, one of the plant oils that will get you not only the adults but the egg in the immature stage, and that might get you better control. Insecticidal soap's great. It'll work on the nymphs but not the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, you know, it's easy for me to say I didn't struggle with whitefly last year. What an accomplishment, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So hopefully you got them under control and won't be bringing any in this year.
Hopefully so.
Okay, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based garden guru, the author of more than 20 books. She is the host of Melinda's Garden Moments. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We turn right back to the telephones here, and Jean and Marcus San, who has a question for you, Melinda. Hi, Jean. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about herbs.
Okay.
I have some growing in my garden. I have basil, oregano, thyme, and parsley, and I would like to grow some inside during the winter. Is it a good idea to dig out some of what I have, or should I start with new plants? And also, what size pot should I use?
You know, I'm a big fan of taking cuttings. If I'm moving things from outside that were in the ground in my garden and I want to grow them inside, taking cuttings for a couple of reasons. It's cleaner growth. It's usually younger, more vigorous growth. Less chance of bringing in insects, those white flies we talked about. And so you have a little bit better control. And rooting them and then potting them up, and usually, you know, if you're starting with a cutting, you can start with a small 3 to 4 inch size pot, and as it outgrows it, then you can move it to a 6 inch pot. More and more garden centers and even grocery stores and farmers markets, of course, are selling herb plants. I find them in a couple of grocery stores I frequent, and I'll find them in the produce area next to the cut herbs, and I'll find plants when I'm having trouble finding them in garden centers. So you could dig them up, but boy, that's heavy soils or rocky soils. You're putting in a potting mix, bringing inside. You're bringing insects from the ground. You're bringing insects on the plant. Take a bunch of cuttings. If you're successful, you can always give them away as gifts to your friends.
Okay.
There you go. Thank you for calling. And Jenny in Coleman, hello to you.
Hi.
Hi,
thanks,
Jenny,
for taking my call. We're relatively new to the whole fruit tree incident, fruit trees and that.
Right.
And you had mentioned something about boring insects in cherry trees.
Mm-hmm.
We have a cherry tree in our, we bought a house 2 years ago, and our cherry tree seems to be dying back, and we're not sure what's going on. What should I be watching for, and what can I do?
Good question. Cherries tend to be short-lived in many parts, but sweet cherry is very hard to grow. I know a few people growing some sweet cherries. Door County, big cherry country. But if you've got in an area with heavy clay soils, late spring frost, you know, they like moist, well-drained soils. They like milder springs, milder winters. So, you know, it's a lot of things going against us here in Wisconsin. Cherries are susceptible to a disease called gomosis, a bacterial disease that will block the flow of water and nutrients, and then you'll often see a smelly ooze coming out of the trunk. That's a sign it's gomosis. Unfortunately, there's not really anything you can do. It's internal. It's bacterial. Just starting new plants away from those that are infected.
Okay.
They also have problems with peach tree borers that will bore in, and you'll usually see holes in the trunk near the base and then even up into the lateral branches. and those are insects that bore into it, and you'll often see sap oozing and holes in the trunk, usually not as smelly as it is with gamosis. Some of the things to do with trees in general, especially those that are subject to borers, is proper moisture, mulching to keep the roots cool and moist, and keep away grass and weeds and things that compete with water and nutrients. And keeping your plants healthy is usually a good way to reduce the risk of any diseases. Keeping in mind, and there's really no cure. You can use some insecticides. You want to read and follow the label. Bayer has a new product. Check the label. I'm not sure cherries are on it. It's citrus, fruit tree, and vegetable. Imidacloprid is the active ingredient absorbed by the plant, concentrates in the leaves, and has been used for emerald ash borer, bronze birch borer, and things like that, if you don't mind using a systemic chemical. If you're looking for more organic control, then proper care is your best bet. And then looking at cherries as a short-term crop, unfortunately, you know, just kind of being prepared to get another one started if one is starting to fade.
Okay, and then just make sure that we do that one away from the one that we currently have.
If possible, as far as possible. Extension has some really good information on their website on growing fruit trees, apples and pears and cherries, plums and peaches. So there's really lots of good information, Wisconsin-based, on the UW Extension website.
Yeah, just go to the UW Extension Learning Store.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much.
You bet. Good luck with that. Nothing better than growing your own fruit and picking and enjoying.
Let's turn to Dalton in Mozanie next. Hi, Dalton. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, last time I called you last year,
you
told us that to leave our carrots in the garden.
Oh, did you do that for... Oh, I'm sorry. My cat just turned on the sound on my computer. Whoa, sorry about that. Okay, so you left your carrots in the garden.
Yep, and... for last year over the winter.
Okay.
And this year, they're a mush.
Oh, you didn't har... Okay, you know what? I didn't explain it carefully. The goal was to leave them in and then harvest them during the winter. I'm sorry. I didn't explain that very well. Ooh, you probably was very upset with me. Sorry. I'm going to owe you a bushel of carrots. We'll have to meet halfway. When did you harvest them? After the ground thawed, or?
After the ground unthawed and all the snow was melted.
Okay. What you may want to do this, and they were in turn to mush, sometimes what happens, so I'm sorry that happened. Here's what we hope goes on, is the ground freezes, it's crunchy, you still can get a shovel through, throw some evergreen boughs or straw on top, and what that does is keep it consistently cold. And what may have happened is if you get a warm spell, so the ground freezes, it gets warm, it may have just gotten too warm, and your carrots, maybe that's why they turn to mush. Maybe if you're willing to give it one more try, just a little corner of your carrot patch, you know, harvest everything else and store it in your fridge and maybe look at, well, we wouldn't get these harvested anyway. I've had really good success doing it, but it could be freeze-thaw cycle, poor drainage in that part, or sometimes if your carrots are damaged, they're more subject to rot. So sorry you didn't have that. Or the first thaw. The other thing I usually do is when it thaws, I dig them all out and use them right then. So the first thaw, snow's usually a good insulator, but if it fell and the ground wasn't cold enough, that might have been an issue too.
Yeah.
So if you're willing, give it one more shot. I'd really like you to call me back next year and say it worked for you, but otherwise I'll have to ship you up some carrots. So
okay.
Thanks for sharing that, though.
Thanks, Dalton.
Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Oh, it was a great call. We have Josh wondering if you could recommend a soil amendment that will help strengthen the stems on his outdoor flowers, particularly glads and dahlias. They're nice and big, but they always fall over.
You know, some of it is make sure they're in good bright sunlight. Good drainage is important. Avoid excess nitrogen, which pushes growth. So using compost and organic matter is a great way because they tend to be lower, lower nutrients, so they're not going to push a lot of excessive growth. And some glads are taller and, you know, need support. So it might be looking to see if you can find a variety that's a little shorter, too.
I saw a really cool planting. Somebody took a piece of lattice, painted it, put it parallel to the ground and elevated it, and then the glads grew up through the holes in the lattice. And just wonderful watching the hummingbirds nectar on the glads. And it was a little bit of structure, so not only did it hold the glads up, but it provided some additional structure and a somewhat of a decorative feature in the garden. So sometimes the solution is finding a support system nearby plants, structures. You know, if you're doing everything right, you know, growing-wise, that it might be something that you'll make happen, but then also something that works very well for you and your time frame.
Ron in Blooming Grove, on to you now. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. In the 50s, our parents bought a 5-in-1 apple tree.
Oh, great.
And I want to do something like that in, up here. So for southern Wisconsin and Illinois, what 5 to 10 varieties of apples are the best to choose? I'm thinking of disease resistance, you know, like scab and things like that. Which varieties will do best under organic growing conditions without sprays, including both, you know, heirloom varieties and modern varieties that might be available at a nursery in Wisconsin?
Okay. Well, and you know what you may have to do is I think you're going to have to get online. There aren't a lot. Young's typically is probably one of the best suppliers of wide variety of fruits. More garden centers are carrying them because more and more people are doing it. You may also want to order online because I think you'll have the best selection and availability that way in terms of looking for varieties that you can grow. I would also suggest, you know, what are your flavor choices that you're looking for? You're going to need a good quality plant. And grafting is tough. So are you looking to buy one already done, or are you looking to do the grafting yourself?
I'm a terrible failure grafting apples over the last 40 years.
Join the club.
Also, I wanted to ask on their glads. For hummingbirds, do they need to be red petals on the glads to attract hummingbirds?
No. Actually, we were shooting in a beautiful garden the other day, and this person had black and blue salvia. We had to duck the hummingbirds buzzing all over the yard, and they're blue. Red is a favorite, and purples are favorites, but they don't have to be. So check that out. I would say whatever you're going to be able to find. I don't know if you've done some research, you know, in terms of varieties, but I think your limitation is going to be finding what's available. So if you buy from a source that's local or in Zone 5, so if you're Illinois, southern Wisconsin, you're going to have good luck. You know, Empire's kind of a cross between Delicious and Macintosh. It's got a little bit of the both Macintosh. Mac Free is a disease, tends to be a disease resistant, as well as Nova Mac. But finding them is also very difficult.
Yeah.
So I think your limitation is going to be what you can find more than what you want.
Yeah.
So, and then also make sure when you buy one that the size of your tree is determined by the rootstock, you know, the dwarfing rootstock. So you want to make sure when you look for it that it gives you an ultimate height, because if it says dwarf, it just has to be smaller than the straight species. But usually they'll give you a height, and that's going to be important too. So I hate to give you a bunch to look for that you're not going to be able to find.
Right.
Makes
sense.
I would try Young's. I would try, I don't know if you can think of any other places, Larry.
Young's is the one that most comes to mind to me because they have a pretty good selection.
Yeah. And they're Wisconsin-based. So yep. you might want to get onto their website and check with them and see what they've got. And I think that's a good starting point. And as for grafting, very few of us can, so you're in the majority. But good luck with that. That's
Thanks, Ron.
It's always fun. Actually, I was at a garden center at Stein Garden Center working, and they have some five grafted apple trees. And I had a young lad ask me, how that happened, only because he was curious, not for any. I thought it must be a school project, right? So there are some out in the garden centers, too, now, too. But if you want something special, check with online or catalog.
Got an email from John in Ashland who says, we have a climbing rose that blooms on new and old wood. What's the best time and method to prune it? Sorry, I don't know the variety.
You know, the good thing is what you'll want to do is you'll get more bloom on mature growth or young growth off of old stems. So in the spring, take out a few of the older canes. I usually start with what's dead, you know, what's bigger, that'll take the growth right down to the, you know, take a few of those down to the ground. That'll encourage new growth from the base. After the first flush of bloom, then you can do some kind of grooming and, you know, managing the overall size. But by taking a few stems down every year, you can control the size and still get maximum bloom as well.
And Melinda, again, let's talk about your website. We got about a minute here to talk about your website and Melinda's Garden Moments as well.
Right. So try to give you as much information as possible on things that are new products, ideas, answer common questions. And I just wanted to mention this cool new application. I'm a low-tech person, as I think I've confessed, but iMyGarden is a great design app. Take a picture of your landscape. You can design your spring flowering bulb garden and win a chance to win $1,000 worth of bulbs. So if you join me on my Facebook, there's some cool information there, or on my website. It's a fun thing. It's easy to do. I could do it, so anyone can. And it's fun to see how your plan can become a reality. So it's a cool application, easy to use, and a chance to win $1,000 worth of bulbs. We could all find a place to plant those.
Oh, yeah. And just go to melindamyers.com. And actually, we have a link to at our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. So you can go there as well. Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books, host of Melinda's Garden Moments, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mealer with my guest, Melinda Myers, a Milwaukee garden expert, author of 20 books or more, and host of Melinda's Garden Moments. Great to have her with us, and thank you so much for listening in. We have lots of callers online. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. So, Melinda, we'll just go right to the phones here. Okay. And Teresa in Heartland. Hi, Teresa.
Hello, Melinda.
Hi, Teresa.
I've got a couple of your books, too, and but I still had a question that I have a couple questions. One is on a redbud tree, and other one is my citrus plants. I have a redbud tree for about 5 or 6 years, I think, and it has never flowered for me, and I don't know why. And even this spring, a few of the branches were dying off, and or limbs were totally dead, and I cut those off, and it came back very well, and it's about like 6 foot tall, and it never had flowers on it. Is that unusual?
Okay. Do you know, is it a Columbus or Minnesota strain, do you know? Of redbud, but I'll start from the beginning and then maybe you can answer that question. Redbuds are kind of borderline in our area. They've done some propagating from redbuds in Columbus, Wisconsin. Someday I'm going to the Redbud Festival there. And I know I'm kind of a geek, but I hear it's very cool. And the streets are lined with redbuds. So they propagated because those were obviously hardy. Minnesota has selected out those that are hardy in their area, zone 4. So hardiness is one issue for plant survival. Redbuds like a protected, like an east location, so a part day of sun, you know, at least a half a day of sun, protected from the winter winds, helpful for survival, and not only at the plant, but the flower buds. Moist but not soggy soils, and then avoid high nitrogen fertilizer. Sometimes over-fertilizing plants, whether it's red fall color we're looking for on burning bush and red maple or good blooming, excessive nitrogen can interfere with flowering and can interfere with some of the aesthetic qualities we're looking for. Sometimes it takes a plant a while to get established. We buy them in bloom in a pot, a container. They're flowering. We put them in the ground. They spend the next few years putting down roots. Now, typically, it's not 7 or 8 years. It may be a couple. So avoiding high nitrogen fertilizer, mulching around the base. We typically, as I mentioned earlier, have high to excessive levels of phosphorus and potassium. So do a soil test before adding more, you know, or again, trying something like the melorganite that helps release, or using compost is a good way too. Just as a top dress, don't bury the roots. Might help stimulate bloom. They do get a disease called verticillium wilt, where you'll get branch dieback. But usually, and you'll want to remove the dead branches beneath the canker, disinfect your tools, but you might have had just winter kill. So I'm wondering if you have one that's a little borderline hardy here, and it's just going to take it a while. Hopefully you should see blooms next spring.
Well, I got it from the Arbor Society.
Oh, yeah, you know what? That
several years ago.
Yeah, I had one of those too, and I called it my redbud bush because it would die back to the ground every year.
Well, no, this hasn't.
No, I need. That's great. That's
yeah.
Wonderful.
This last year, it was only like one side of the tree had some dead branches, and I
right.
cut them off, and it came back wonderfully.
Excellent. And that's, yeah, so that's not going to flower, obviously, because the flower buds are already set. Those are southern variety ones, and that might be, you know, that's
excellent. Probably the problem.
Yeah, that's excellent that you've had good luck. I would wait and see you. Obviously, you've had good luck, TLC, some good winters. And
well, I mulched it, and I fertilized it maybe the second year, but I've never fertilized it after that.
Okay, I wouldn't do any more fertilizing. Just
because
sure
I figured that just produces more green growth and not flowers.
You're absolutely right. So it sounds like you have one of the southern ones, but you've had good success keeping it going, and I just wait and see. You might be just getting some flower bud die back over winter as well as stem growth. So I'd give
well,
it another year.
I never saw any flower buds at all.
No.
Pardon me?
I never saw any flower buds appear at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they've set already because they bloom on old wood. So they're probably getting killed over winter, so they're not swelling up. So
that's
one
the
of
problem.
Possibilities. Yeah.
That might be one you need to apply a chainsaw to.
I'm like threatened death, get it another year. Just take your chainsaw out, rub it up beside the red bud.
It has a lot of growth on it. It's like about 6 or 7 foot tall.
Right.
Well,
when I cut those dead branches off this winter, it's the only time it really had anything dead on it. It was some winter kill, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it came back really well.
Right. So, but you're not getting blooms. And what I'm saying is like lilacs and forsythia and other things that are spring bloomers, they set their flower buds in advance, so you don't see them until they start to swell. But if they've been winter killed,
yep,
that might be that's a possibility.
That's a very definite possibility.
If you like it, I think they're beautiful trees even when they don't bloom. So if you've got good luck, you like the way it looks, it's got wonderful form, enjoy it, and maybe you'll get blooms some years and not every year. But
mm-hmm.
you know, that could be your added benefit.
And you had another. Oh, we lost her. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Lori in Chautauqua. Hi, Lori. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A woman had called in about cherry trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we just planted cherry trees last year, so it's all new to us. But when you were talking about the borers and the holes in the trunk of the trees, we've got arborvitas that are getting all these little tiny holes in them, and the insects that I've seen that I think are making them, they look like a little tiny ant. We never had them other years. This was the first year, and the barks of the trees, the arborvitas, they just got holes all over them.
Are they areas where the that are bare, they don't have branches coming out, that you're seeing them? I mean, could it be sapsucker damage or woodpecker? Typically, I don't think of arborvitae being attacked by those birds, but there aren't a lot of borers that hit arborvitae. And sometimes a bird looking for insects can cause small holes. Ants are usually a secondary issue. They're usually around
right.
when there are mites or aphids and they're going after the honeydew. Carpenter ants are a whole different issue. And then you'll see sawdust and things. Are the arborvitaes looking okay?
Well, some of them are, but the holes aren't, they're kind of, I'm looking at them right now at my window.
Okay.
They're on the inside. They're not on the outside of the barks. They're on the inside, but they're kind of like almost in a design, like, 4 or 5 across and just...
Oh,
yeah,
that's a bird.
Yeah, that's a bird going after the insects. And sometimes using scare tactics, kind of putting something over the area where they're feeding to discourage them so they go somewhere else. But those are birds typically, and I forget the direction, and you may be able to help me. One pattern's usually when they're looking for a mate, and one's when they're looking for an insect. But I don't. Maybe that's something.
I don't remember if it's up or down there.
You're okay, so I'm not imagining it.
No.
So they're going after the insects, and usually the damage isn't severe enough to hurt your tree. But if you're concerned, then you need to do something to scare the birds to prevent them from going after the tree to feed on it. And if your tree's healthy, there's not a concern. And usually, arborvitae, as long as they're getting proper care, insects. I don't really see a lot of boring insect problems. So I think they're just going for some of the bugs in the bark just below the surface. And proper care is probably your best bet. Ants are secondary. I just keep an eye on them. And then watch, and maybe strips of nylon, you know, cloth or something, clanging pans, something to keep the birds away may help get them to feed somewhere else.
Thanks for calling, Lori. Appreciate it. Sue in Appleton, we're on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Melinda and
Hi,
Larry.
Sue.
Hi.
I am wondering, when you burn black walnut trees and hickory, does the juglans remain in the ash, or is it volatile?
You know, that's a really good question. Typically, when the product is decomposed, it's not an issue anymore. So, like, if you threw your black walnut leaves and husks and wood and it was decomposed to the point it looks just like regular compost, usually by then that juglone is not an issue. I don't know about the ash. That's a really good question.
I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, that might be one that you might want to use it in. And ash is not the best soil amendment anyway. It doesn't tend to improve our drainage. It tends to be very alkaline, so those of us with high pH soils, that can be an issue. So it might be one that you maybe have a special compost pile that you add it to your compost, and by the time your compost is broken down, I would be guessing that that juglone would also be taken care of. But then, you know, then using it on plants that you know aren't susceptible, just as a double.
Well, my whole yard, it's pretty bad. When we moved here, the soil test was 000. So we'll take what we can get.
Who did your soil test?
I've never heard of that.
Exactly. I think
we went through the co-op.
Okay. Because I've never heard of no nutrients at all. So you might want to have a state-certified lab do a soil test, because typically to have zero parts per million, you would have nothing growing at all.
When we got here, there wasn't.
Okay.
And I have lilacs that in the 10 years have only, they're a little more than waist high, even the wild lilac, you know.
Okay, and do you have a lot of black walnut on the property? Is that why?
No, I was just wondering about that because we do burn a lot.
Okay, because one of the things that would be great to do is using organic top dressing. You know, getting a hold of if your nutrient value is that low, fertilization is one part of the solution, but then improving the soil. You know, by amending it before planting or shredding leaves and putting it on the soil surface or top dressing an inch of compost over your planting beds, all of that over time is going to help too. So it sounds like you've got a good start, but it sounds like, boy, you have a challenge ahead of you.
Yeah.
So
there had been a barn on this site, and they burned the barn and then buried it.
Okay.
And I think when they covered it up, they just used the bottom soil to cover it.
Oh no. So yeah, that could be an issue. And if there's a lot of wood product in there, you might have some nitrogen deficiencies.
We don't have any like mycorrhizae or anything like that either. No worms, no nothing.
That's where compost will help you too.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got a local municipality doing composting, because it sounds like you're going to need a lot, or friends that are doing composting, you can purchase compost too. But sounds like you have a big project, so you might want to work with some of the products that might be recycled in your community to start with.
Yep, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Sue. Let's turn to Steve in Richland Center next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. I've got a recently acquired tobacco shed, and it's very old. And up in the loft of this shed, there's a very old heap of straw or hay. I'm not sure which it is. It's kind of a brown fibrous mass, and it's, you know, it's the size of a truck.
Wow.
So can I use that for mulch on my garden, or does it contain, you know, some bad stuff? It might have been sitting there for 50 years for all I know.
Yeah, it wouldn't be so much that it would be toxic. It's just how many seeds are in there.
How many weed seeds?
Yeah, so
would
it might
be dead by now, though?
No, you know what? Michigan State University did this research. In the late 1800s, they buried all these vials full of weed seeds throughout this garden area, and they were digging them up every 5 years to check viability 100%. So now they're doing it like every
10 or 15 years because they figure they're going to run out of seeds. Because even as recently as 20 years ago, they were viable. Now, being up in the loft, they may have frozen out, but there's no guarantee. So, you know, it's just one of those that I think the worst that would happen would you'd have some weeds to pull. So you may want to try it on a small patch and see. Mm-hmm. If you have an abundance of weeds, then you go, not worth it. And if you don't have many, then it's probably something good you can use throughout your garden area.
Is there any great advantage to using it?
Well,
is it any different than in straw that would have been, you know,
well, straw would be
century somewhere?
Right.
Straw would probably be better than hay.
Right, because
yeah.
Usually there are fewer weed seeds, and it's always hard to find straw and weed-free. So, yeah, Larry's exactly right. So you have it, and it's free. That's the advantage.
Yeah.
And how are you going to get rid of it? So it might be one of those to try it on a small area so that if it is a weed problem, you're not infesting your whole garden. And if it isn't, then that might be a good indication that those weed seeds have either fallen out or frozen or not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, thank
good
you.
Luck with
yeah,
that.
Thanks a lot. Pat in East Troy, on to you. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry. And I'm
Hi, Pat.
Happy to have you on. I was on my way out to cut down an old lilac bush that's my grandmother planted probably 100
uh-huh.
years ago. And it's a foot across. How far down should I be cutting that to try to stimulate new growth?
When you say it's a foot across,
the diameter of a twisted double trunk.
So it's one single trunk?
Well, it started out to be two, but it wound itself around and it's all fused together.
Okay, and I'm glad you brought that up. Well, first of all, you probably heard the discussion about if you want flowers, you prune after flowering. And when you have a single trunk lilac, you obviously can't cut it back to that single trunk back to the ground. It may resprout, but boy, you're taking a big chance, and especially when it's an heirloom, you know, your grandmother's plant. Kind of a rule of thumb is taking a third. You may end up with a lilac, quasi-lilac tree shrub that you're going to have this gnarly trunk showing, and you're going to take some of the branches back to that to encourage growth closer to the base of the plant. How close are the branches coming off from the ground? So you have that main trunk, and then where do you see some branches sprouting off of that?
It's a mass of sprouts coming out of the ground for probably 10 feet around.
Oh, okay. Oh. I'm sorry. I thought you only had one trunk.
Well, there are two more besides this twisted one that I'm planning to get rid of.
And okay. then you have all those sprouts coming up.
Yes.
In much better shape.
Right, exactly. Larry and I had the same picture in our head, like, whoa, because I've seen those with just one trunk. I would take the biggest one if you're willing to take it, and you've got all these suckers, and you've got the second and third layer of size ones, as close to the ground as you can, 6 or 12 inches above ground. If you're a little nervous, you can reduce the height, but the benefit is trying to get more of those suckers to take over. Because you eventually want to get all the old growth back to ground level so all your suckers are giving you leaves from ground to the tip because you're done with that. But if you can't do it as far back as you can tolerate and leave all those small stems coming up, those are the new growth. That's what's going to flower for you in the future, and you're going to train those into your shrub.
Okay.
And you're going to get rid of the old ones. You know, and if it's, and I know you take out the saw and you look at it and you think of, oh, it's the family lilac.
Exactly.
You know, if you can't take that whole big one down to the ground, take it down as far as you can. And then over time, you'll gain the confidence to get rid of it totally.
As long as it doesn't deck me on its way down.
Well, that's
no.
true.
Be careful, Pat.
I have one other question. I have a garden full of rhubarb. How late is it safe or a good idea to use it for food?
You know, rhubarb can be harvested any time during the growing season, but we don't like to do it during the growing season so the plants can put energy back in. Fall harvests are great, one or two, right? You know, that's going to die anyway. So, you know, right before a killing frost or towards the end of the season, make a harvest or two. Once they freeze, there was some research out of Cornell or somewhere that when rhubarb freezes, there is some movement of the oxalic acid.
Yes.
That's the concern from the leaves to the stem. So you don't want to do it after a frost. But, you know, when you're saying, okay, I think we have another 2 weeks, maybe I'll give it a week in the garden to grow, maybe take a couple light harvests, you know, but after frost, no.
Nope. There you go. Thanks, Pat. Kate in Wisconsin Rapids. Hello to you.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I love listening to this show.
Thank you.
I have a lovely blaze maple tree.
Okay.
That I planted probably about 14 years ago. Was doing really well, being neglected all those years. And now half of it, it started last year, half of it, the leaves start to curl up and turn brown, and now they're red and falling off, and the other half stays green. And also the bark has peeled off in areas, quite big chunks. And I'm wondering what it could possibly have going on.
I'm guessing it's an autumn blaze maple, which is a Freeman-type maple, a cross between the silver and red. Fast-growing, tolerates our alkaline soil in the south better, usually has the red color of the red maple and the toughness of the silver. A couple things come to mind when I hear maples having those kind of symptoms. Verticillium wilt is an issue on all your maples,
okay.
And it has a branch-by-branch dieback, and there's not a lot you can do. Sometimes pruning can save them, but if half the tree is gone, it's going to look pretty bad. So you might want to get a certified arborist out to look at it. Trees planted too deep, also we get some rot happening at the base, at the soil crown. Trees, the root flare needs to be at or slightly above the soil surface. And often in the nursery, they're, you know, with just the practices and the balling and the, you know, planting and things like that, sometimes the root ball can end up a little deep. So, you know, when we plant, we try to pull the soil back, plant it with the root flare at or slightly above. And girdling roots can also cause that, where something caused the root to, you know, make a turn and start circling the trunk. Often, I know, none of these are sounding good, are they?
No.
Often,
they aren't.
and it's just at that mature phase. So, I think your best bet is to get a certified arborist in to take a look, because they can, you know, and then do some searches yourself, you know, do a search on verticillium wilt and girdling root, and do an advanced search with a .edu extension.
Okay.
So you get reliable resources. Trees Are Good, which is the public website by the International Society of Arboriculture, also has some good information on planting and care, and some on, and also finding certified arborist. Wisconsin Arborist Association has a list of certified arborists in Wisconsin as well. So those are some places to go and do a little research. You know, it's always good to kind of have some information in your back pocket, find a good qualified arborist. I think if they can come out, you know, it may not be as bad a picture as I'm painting. Let's hope so, anyway. So I wish you luck, because at 15, it's probably looking really beautiful, and you'd hate to lose it. So it'll be worth the investment to try to save that tree, or get someone out to tell you if it's worth the investment to save.
Thanks, Kate. Thank you for calling. And Judith has posted that free app.
Oh, good. Thank you, Judith.
Yeah, the garden guru Melinda Myers talked about here. So if you want to get on it in the next couple of days.
Right. I should have mentioned the deadline's pretty close. But
a chance to win $1,000 worth of flower bulbs.
Yes, exactly. It's worth it. And I think we all create better under pressure.
And we can still be putting those bulbs in now?
Oh, yeah. You know what? It's just starting to get to be the time. We have these week of cool temperatures. We want the soil nice and cool. So our northern Wisconsin gardening buds can start right now. Those of us in the south, start shopping so you get the best selection. And you got a few weeks before you even need to get started. So plenty of time.
Thank you so much, Melinda. It's always such a pleasure to have you with
us. Thank you, Larry. And thanks for having me on. And everyone have a great fall.
And again, you can go to Melinda Myers. Let's see, what's her, melindamyers.com, isn't it? Let's see here. Tell you what, go to My Garden, iMyGarden. It's an iPhone app, and you can find it at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's do it that way. Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, we'll have her back again. And thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.